Los de Abajo with Resistencia and Fermin Muruguruza and the Suicide of Western Culture with San Andreu. That about does it for this week's edition of Radio Free Chico. I'll see you again next week. Stay tuned for Sue and peace and social justice. That's it. I have to have things written down. I need cue cards. I'll see you later. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
That revolution starts right now. Welcome to Peace and Social Justice this fine Friday morning. This is Sue Hildebrand sitting in for Chris Nelson for this edition of Peace and Social Justice. This edition of Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with Century 21 Select, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with kind, quality service. Patrick can be reached by calling 588-6593. You can also find him on Facebook. So this edition is also made possible by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. So today on Peace and Social Justice, we will first talk about housing growth and Chico's general plan. Then, for the noon until 1 p.m. hour, we'll talk about water with Ron Topi. Ron Topi is not only a programmer here at KZFR, but he is an advocate for water, especially for the North State salmon and the waters that support those salmon run. Ron will give us an update on the current state of the winter and spring salmon runs, which is not particularly good. And then he'll talk about the latest efforts to save the winter run Chinook from extinction in the North State. So to begin, the shelter crisis in Chico and throughout Butte County is pretty much common knowledge at this point. The lack of affordable housing was evident even before the campfire in 2018. One of the most knowledgeable people in Chico about housing is housing and land use consultant Addison Winslow. Addison Winslow was on The Real Issue this past Wednesday night talking about the current process of creating the housing element for Chico's general plan. If you didn't hear that particular edition of The Real Issue, I encourage you to go back to our archives. All you have to do is go to kzfr.org. You go to programs, hit Wednesday, and it's on The Real Issue. It was archived yesterday. It's an amazing interview. It is so informative about the growth of Chico and what we need to do moving forward to maintain a livable community into the future. So, again, on that program, Addison talked specifically about the housing element of the general plan. And, of course, a general plan is required by all cities and counties in order to help project public service requirements, especially for a growing community. So the housing element of the general plan, once it's reviewed by the City Planning Commission, is then forwarded to the Chico City Council to be voted on, and ultimately it'll be adopted as part of the general plan through 2030. So now the meeting of the Planning Commission took place last night, and Addison Winslow was there. He is on the phone with me right now to give an update on that process and how the discussions went last night during the Planning Commission. I'm happy to have you back here with me on Peace and Social Justice, Addison Winslow.
Hey, always a pleasure to chat with you.
So last night was the Chico Planning Commission meeting to review the proposed housing element that would eventually be adopted for inclusion in the general plan. And you are currently consulting with Butte Environmental Council to review and make comments on that housing element. So first, Addison, talk about the plan as it was presented to the commission, and then talk about your major concerns about the draft and the comments that you and that BEC, through your consultation, entered into the public record.
Right. So Chico's undergone a lot of really significant changes in the last few years, and especially going back to 2011 when the current general plan was adopted. This housing element doesn't propose any substantial changes. There have also been a lot of changes to state law that should affect the process. And Chico has, this staff is proposing doing what's essentially the bare minimum to try to scrape by to come into compliance with those laws. And that means under some conditions allowing somewhat more dense housing where previously we don't. That's at the core of a lot of issues is that Chico has become a larger community. Once we surpassed 100,000 people, which was on the day of the campfire, we're qualified according to the state for these purposes as a metropolitan jurisdiction. And what that means is that we should be allowing housing of a certain density in order to qualify for low-income housing. The state recognizes that density can be a proxy for affordability because when you have larger mass buildings, you have shared walls, shared foundation, smaller units, all these things contribute to allowing these units to come at a more affordable rate. But Chico really, when you compare it with other cities of Chico's size, does not allow very, very dense housing. We only in particular corridors and downtown would theoretically allow the housing. It doesn't, and especially downtown, doesn't turn out to be very feasible because of the parking requirements that are also on it. So it's we've really failed to promote redevelopment in downtown and, for the most part, along these transportation corridors that they call the corridor opportunity sites. So one of the critiques and the recommendations could go a lot of ways. Essentially, what it is we have to find more places where low-income housing can be accommodated within Chico, and in particular, we're looking at areas. We should be looking at areas of high opportunity where there are, you know, good retail services nearby, where places that are valued by the community, where you might have like street trees and proximity to parks and downtown itself. Walkability, you know, is really important, and definitely from Environmental Council's standpoint, we want to see low-income housing put in areas where people are able to meet all of their basic needs, including work and recreation on foot, not relying on automobiles. And as we talked about on Wednesday, I think the biggest inhibition to Chico seeing the kind of development that in our plans we say we want to see is that we can't decouple the idea of housing coming with people with cars. And so whenever there's a big housing development proposed, the biggest issue people see is that people come with cars, and there's going to be parking problems, there's going to be traffic problems, and there certainly are air quality and noise issues that come with that too. So what the critiques center around is that the typical zoning that Chico allows apartments in does not meet the state standards for what a jurisdiction of Chico's size should allow. And so we really need to see a change in those zonings all across the city, and that's something that the city staff did not propose in this draft.
Oh, that is interesting. That's really interesting, because we talked a lot about this on Wednesday night on The Real Issue, and again, for folks that missed it, Addison Winslow gave us a real overview of how Chico developed from way back in the beginning, where the density grew from, you know, of course, downtown as usual, and the transportation corridors, and how that changed with cars, and now our love affair with cars requires that we will not give up our parking spaces, which is contrary to what we're looking for. It's interesting, I guess, if you mentioned it on Wednesday, I missed it, but it is interesting that you're saying our typical zoning here in Chico is not compatible with what is required for a city this size, and the zoning actually prevents us from having the density that we're looking for. One of the things that you mentioned, Addison, is that you said what we say we want. And I want you to clarify that for a second. When you say, you know, it's contrary to what we say we want, who is the we, and how do you know what we want?
These things are pretty clearly stated in the general plan, in the policy goals. And particular phrase that I like comes out of the sustainability element. And that was a voluntary portion of the general plan that Chico opted to do. Says that Chico should aspire to be the green city of the North State, and that means a lot of things. That, you know, we also have a love affair with trees, and that's good, and that's something that's emphasized in that statement. But it's also, you can find it in, we have the land use element, and see we have a downtown element some of the policies are support development and redevelopment of these opportunity sites, strengthen downtown with a variety of land uses, mixed use developments and redevelopment throughout downtown. We have specific policies supporting higher density residential development in downtown, and in particular, in these policies have been around. This particular one has been since at least 1976. Chico has said that we want to see city-owned parking lots redeveloped with high-density housing.
Yeah, Since 1970s, that's amazing. That's amazing. Let me just say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Peace and Social Justice. I am not Chris Nelson. I'm sitting in for Chris. She is on a well-deserved vacation. This is Sue Hildebrand, and I have Addison Winslow on the phone with me. He is one of the handful of experts on housing and land use here in Chico and Butte County, and he just submitted comments on behalf of Butte Environmental Council last night at the Planning Commission meeting for the housing element, which will become part of the city's general plan that will take our planning into 2030. Addison, you mentioned that that one of the major critiques that was submitted in response to the draft housing element is that the zoning needs to change. Our current zoning is not compatible with what we say we want as a community. Were there other major red flags for you in terms of the draft housing element?
It sort of all comes down to inaction, and given the fact that Chico's grown so much, given the fact that the housing crisis has emerged from what was really, I think, in 2011, sort of in the back of people's minds. I mean, we, in a way, like, overbuilt housing, and that was what led to the recession. We had lots of empty houses
around.
Right,
right.
This situation is totally transformed, and especially with the byproduct of that, which is the homelessness. I people really want to see something change, but the housing element just is not, it's not going above and beyond to try to meet these community goals, which are listed in there, and you can read them in the draft housing element. Things like, you know, supporting more growth of low-income housing and such.
Right. It seems that a lot of, as you say, that one of the major critiques is the issue of inaction. We know what we want, but the city is not proactively using resources in order for us to achieve what we want, which is clearly stated in those general plans, in the housing element of the general plan. I don't want to go too far in the weeds on this question, but we touched on it briefly on Wednesday on The Real Issue, where I made the comment that in terms of profitability, the city tends to allow or at least behave, whether this is by design or not, but the way that the city behaves in terms of proactivity for affordable housing is that it sort of has faith in the market. Is that a correct assessment? I mean, you say it's inaction, and I always think of it as the city's MO tends to be let the developers figure it out, allow that, and how do we overcome that attitude?
So that's like a very real thing you're describing, and this is an interesting conversation, and these policies we're talking about is interesting because it's not so much a question of the city using resources to create low-income housing. Like, the city does have these parking lots that that we could decide are excessive, or there's better uses for them, and we could partner and redevelop them. But it's really a matter of the city stepping out of the way and allowing a developer to build housing that can be affordable to low-income households. The majority of the city, especially the majority of the residential land in the city, is zoned just low-density. So you can only have, the state has loosened that a little bit, so you can have some more small units on a house, but on a property. But you're not allowed to build a small apartment building. Now, if you go through the avenues in Barber, if you're familiar with the older neighborhoods or South Campus, you can see that there are single family houses that have been built out over years into multiple units, or there are small apartment buildings. This is what's termed the missing middle housing. You know, it's not a large apartment complex along the railroad track or on a major road. They're peppered throughout the neighborhood. And those were built in Chico primarily in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and sometime in the 1990s, the city decided to ban future growth, and especially throughout the central neighborhoods where the proximity to downtown gives that land value to where developers had invested in it. And it's the sort of thing that it doesn't require millions of dollars to put up a small, like, you know, fourplex or something. There's some really, like, neat ones throughout Chico. That would now be illegal to reconstruct in most of the land. And that's something that where, like, somebody owns a house and they have the capacity to expand on their house and split it into multiple units and rent some of those out. And that provides low-income housing to people. And so, like, they would be developers. And there are certainly developers that do that. And the majority of the development industry in Chico has a strong infatuation and preference for building large single-family houses for higher-income individuals. It requires less investment on their part. They sort of can subdivide land as an export product, and we have these wealthier people from the Bay Area or L.A. who might move to Chico to buy those. And that market certainly exists, and there's a preference for that. But it really is the questions in this housing element, what the city is not doing and not proposing to do, is about the city standing in the way of developers from building housing, but it's building the housing that we need, that's documented that we need.
Right, Right. Addison Winslow, Butte Environmental Council was not the only organization that had submitted comments. In fact, a Sacramento group submitted comments. First of all, why would a Sacramento group care about housing here in Chico? And then also, what were their comments? Were they consistent with what you had noticed and what Beck had actually submitted?
That was a really inspiring occurrence to see that they submitted some very good comprehensive comments. It's a group called House Sacramento, and it's part of a broader statewide movement that's really like erupted in recent years because everywhere in the state is experiencing similar problems with Chico, even though it's probably worse in Chico than most areas. But it's associated with you hear the Yindi groups, Yes in My Backyard, sort of a response to this cultural movement that's in the latter half of the 20th century, the Not in My Backyard movement, where people want to shoot down housing projects. And as I mentioned, it's usually on the basis of the effects of car traffic that come with it. So this group, they say they have a goal of promoting greater housing growth for people with low incomes, young people who are typically excluded or disproportionately affected by the effects of NIMBYism. And so they're concerned with Chico too. And this housing element process, the update is going on across the state. A lot of Southern California has already gone through it, and that's informed my work here, knowing what how these new state laws are enforced, can be enforced, and what sort of things cities are doing that that are now illegal, and what better things they can do. This group has had previously participated in criticizing the housing elements of Davis. In Sacramento, I believe they've sent in something on Yuba City, and now they've left up here in Chico. I'm honestly not sure whether they got wind of the work that I was doing because I have been in touch with some of the statewide Yindi groups, and they have what's called the Campaign for Fair Housing Elements that I've been in touch with.
Mm-hmm.
It was very very gratifying and inspiring to see them chime in, and I will say that their comments were consistent with the comments that that Beck produced, especially that one emphasizing that our typical zoning for apartments is inadequate for low-income housing and should not be included. We shouldn't be assuming that low-income housing would be built there because we don't have housing being built at high enough densities to where it really allows the economies of scale necessary to produce low-income housing. They also noted some other things that I didn't include in the comments of the Planning Commission because I really wanted to keep it as brief as possible, hoping that they would read it. We have not finished our full comments, and there's a lot of issues in the housing element. There's a lot of almost like clerical things in accounting for low-income housing. There's particular constraints on certain sites that the city is saying should produce low-income housing that conflicts with a previous analysis of the city saying that there's actually a low probability that will be developed. And so they did kind of a Google Maps analysis and noted some curious things about some of the sites that would make it less than likely that something will be developed there. And one, something I didn't notice, there's a site far on North Esplanade that the city said they would anticipate low-income housing being built, but they looked at the map and saw that there's actually an apartment building already on that site. So staff did recommend, based on those, discount that site or take it off the site inventory because, yes, there was already an apartment building there, and they probably are not going to knock down the apartment building to build another apartment building. It's not something that we should expect anyway.
Right. Addison Winslow, I only have about another minute with you. So what happened, what typically happens is a draft is presented, public comment, and then the Planning Commission votes on it to move it along, and then it goes to the City Council and they adopt it. That's not what happened. So in my last minute with you, tell us what did happen and what is the process moving forward and how listeners can find out more about this, maybe even participate in this process.
Yeah, so again, what happened bodes well for the prospects of getting a better address to the housing issues that we have. Some of our commissioners, Rich Ober and Bryce Goldstein, and Lindsay Pullen, were very vocal that they didn't want to see this as just something that we check the box and we pass it along and then we just do our own business kind of irrespective of it. We actually want to take this as a format and an opportunity to try and address these problems, and not just a state mandate. And Given that the majority of the commission, Commissioner Larry Wall and former supervisor was absent, Commissioner Paul Cooper wanted to just send it along with no comments, and it wasn't clear that he had read it. But the other commissioners were really keen on actually providing some constructive criticism and seeing this improve. And being that there really wasn't enough time there in 5 minutes that I had to speak, and given that we had received these comments that named a lot of pretty major issues with the housing element, they wanted us to further work on it. So they scheduled a follow-up planning commission meeting that's going to be June 16th on another Thursday at 6 p.m. in the city council chambers to further discuss it, and hoping that more members of the public would come out and speak about it. And I would say that even though some of these issues can seem very technical, I would encourage people to show up and you know, say what kind of housing you want to see and how much importance should be given to that, and how we should compare that with the issues of people not wanting new housing in their neighborhood. And that would be a really good opportunity, because it appears that the Planning Commission really wants to be pro-housing here. But we do need to promote that, and we do need to give good guidance for them to make those decisions and recommendations to the city council.
Yeah, I mean, you made a quick point where you said this commission is pro housing, and I think you'll agree with me. Everybody is pro housing, and so the question here in the housing element, which will be part of the general plan, is a matter of what kind of housing will result in the livable quality community that we want to live in. Really, in my last 10 seconds. Addison Winslow, where can people read your comments as well as read the draft housing element?
The draft housing element you can find on chicohousingelement.com. It'll pop up with a little thing when you go to the website. It'll say download draft, and you can look through it. I encourage you to look at the maps on there, especially the sites inventory map. That one of those sites inventory maps was also shared on Butte Environmental Council's social media, and we'll be sure to share our comments going forward there too. So make sure you just keep track of that on social media, or sign up for updates, sign up as a member if you aren't. And that's where you find the best information, and show up to the meeting. Do consider coming. Even if you don't know much, it's good to have more people in the room, more voices.
And it's a good opportunity to learn more about it.
Most certainly.
Addison Winslow, as always, you are a wealth of information. Thanks once again for your time. And for listeners, if you didn't catch Wednesday night's program, go to kzfr.org. Look for the archives. Addison gave an amazing interview, explained so much that many of us, I don't think, knew, and it really clears up a lot. So, Addison, thanks again for the work that you do.
I really appreciate you having me.
All right, so we are going to take a really quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about salmon. I have Ron Topi here in the studio with me. Don't go away. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, where they were put in boxes, and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martinis dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university, where they are put in boxes, and they come out all the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family in boxes it's made of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. There's a pink one, and a green one, and a blue one, and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
Yeah, the great Malvina Reynolds, Little Boxes, Little Boxes. You are listening to Peace and Social Justice, and this edition is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Gifting Wellness Fair on Sunday, June 5th. That's from 12 until 5 p.m. at Creating a Sustainable You. And they're located at 811 East 5th Avenue here in Chico. The fair focuses on pampering, self-care, exercise, mental wellness, and all things beautiful. There's no charge to attend this outdoor event. Kids' activity and food. Well-mannered animals are welcome. That's the Gifting Wellness Fair, Sunday, June 5th, at Creating a Sustainable You. They're located at 811 East 5th Avenue in Chico. This edition is also made possible by the Bankruptcy Law Offices of Michael O. Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. Michael O. Hayes offers complimentary consultations and payment plans for Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. For more information, visit chicobk.com, or you can give him a call at 530-892-8916. We're going to be right back talking about water and talking about salmon.
Defending the rights of the waters that flow beneath.
Right, and that, of course, is our beloved Mom Muse. It's their latest single, and it was put out for Aqua Alliance, the defenders of North State water. So we turn now to the topic of salmon, the winter and spring salmon runs, and fundamentally, this is an issue of water. We'll spend the next hour on this topic getting an update on the salmon situation here in the North State and the efforts currently taking place to save the winter run Chinook salmon that, quite frankly, is close to extinction. To talk about salmon, Ron Topi is not only a programmer here at KZR, and he does a monthly program called the North State Water Report, but he's also an advocate for water and for the North State salmon. Ron is here to give us an update on the current state of the salmon runs, and as well as to talk about some of the new things that have been discovered, some good, some bad. Regardless, I am so happy to welcome you here to Peace and Social Justice, Ron Topi.
Thanks, Sue. It's great to be here today. Seems like I'm in this station more and more these days with my own show. Am I coming in?
You are. You know, the microphones are numbered incorrectly. We have to make a note of that and switch up the microphone numbers. So we're good. Now I hear you. So welcome to Peace and Social Justice.
I don't really hear myself that well in my headphones, but
it is something's going on here. Give it to me, Ron.
Okay.
There's hardly. Why don't you try that microphone? Let's see if that's any better.
How's this one?
That one's much better.
Let's do that.
Yeah, let's do that one. Maybe that one. Maybe we got a loose wire. So welcome to Peace and Social Justice, Ron Topi.
Thanks for having me, Sue.
So before we kind of jump into getting the update, I do want to kind of pick your brain a little bit. What I mean by that is, I've known you a while now.
Pretty much since I moved here.
Yeah, like
2009.
Yeah. So 14 years, that is a long time in my lifetime anyway, because I'm very young.
Seems like it was yesterday to me.
But. Yeah. Yep, I agree. And you do a monthly program, the North State Water Report. And so maybe you aren't here often enough for listeners. So what I want to do is ask you, talk about kind of the way that you have made your way to becoming really a protector of the water.
It really started once I moved here, and you know, in 2009 I moved here, and within the first few months of living here in Chico, I landed at a intentional farming community. Many of the listeners out there probably know about the old Grub Cooperative out on Dayton Road and the corner of Dayton Road and McIntosh. And within the first couple of years of living here and being on that farm and observing what was going on with the wells, we had two different wells on that property. One was a deeper well, and one was into a very shallow underground stream. Watching what happened with those wells and how one of them completely dried up, wouldn't even work anymore, and then the other one dropped over 30 feet in the 7 years that I was out there. Made me really aware that, wow, this water thing in this state is pretty bad, and it's pretty drastic. And, you know, that, along with getting to know a lot of people, I was working at Chico Natural Foods, and, you know, I met a lot of people when I first got here to Chico, and one person in particular that I became friends with and very interested in what he had to say all the time is Jim Brobeck, who many of our listeners know, and he is a local icon pretty much. And you know, he's a water policy analyst for Aqua Alliance, and he's also an amazing artist, singer, songwriter, and I just, you know, I used to love spending the afternoons, the hot afternoons in the summer. I would go to 1 mile after farming all morning and just to jump in and cool off. And I'd always find Jim sitting under a tree with his lap steel guitar. And I'd go sit with him and just listen. And then we'd start talking. And he'd just tell me all these things about water and what he knew. And that was another part of my journey. And then a few years later, I was introduced to the Winnemem Wintu tribe and have become very close with them, and, you know, specifically Chief Killeen Sisk, who is the spiritual leader, chief of that small tribe and very, very active in salmon restoration and protecting water. Yeah, that led me to eventually, about a year and a half ago, I decided that I really needed to come on the radio and start talking about all this stuff that seems so important to me, but I don't see a lot of people talking about. You know, there's only a few reporters out there that really write about what's really happening with water, and one of them is another person that was a big inspiration for me to start this program. His name is Dan Bakker. And he's an investigative, you know, an independent investigative journalist. He's been writing about water and fish in the state of California for over three decades now. And I can't emphasize enough how important what Dan has to say is if you want to understand water policy and what's happening with fish. Read Dan's work. Go to the internet and just Google search Dan Bakker, and his last name is spelled B-A-C-H-E-R, Dan Bakker, and you'll get, you know, dozens of articles that will lead you to other articles, and Dan is a wealth of very important information, and he holds a lot of data. He sits in a lot of meetings, hundreds and hundreds of them.
And not only that, and we're going to get into Run for Salmon, not only did you decide that you were going to share this information by way of KZFR, you are proactively part of, in one way, bringing back the salmon here to the North State through your participation in Run for Salmon. Give us just a quick overview of Run for Salmon, because that is going to come back as a theme throughout this hour.
Yeah, after the first couple of years that I was introduced to the Winnemem and became closer and closer, and you know, I now go to ceremony with them often, and they started this prayer called Run for Salmon, and they came to me because they had a 2-day bicycle ride segment of it that they wanted organized, because the whole journey originally went from the bay all the way up to the mountains on the McLeod River. So it was, you know, over 280 or over 300 miles, I believe, the whole journey. And, you know, it's almost a 3-week journey up the river, and there's walking and running and bicycling and paddling on the water all the way up. And they wanted 2 days by bike. And they asked me because they knew that I'm a, you know, avid cyclist, and so I organized the first first bike ride portion of year one, and since then I've just become more and more part of the main organizing team for Run for Salmon year after year, and gained a much deeper and deeper understanding of an indigenous salmon people's approach to the water and the salmon and our relation to all of that.
Ron Topi, that is the perfect comment for us to segue into getting an update on the health of the salmon. As you mentioned, working with Run for Salmon annually gives you a much deeper appreciation to, using your words, the salmon people. And from that perspective, which just gives me chills, it's that deep understanding of what it means to live with the salmon. So give us an update on the status, the health of the salmon here in the North State. Last year we did a report that last year might be the very last run for the Winter Run Chinook. Weren't even sure if they were going to survive. Give us an update on that, and then give us a larger update on the health of the salmon overall, not just the Winter Run.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, I'm just going to give, you know, kind of a basic outline of you know, what are the main factors contributing with the historical declines of Chinook salmon in you know, specifically California, because that's, you know, kind of what we're talking about here, is, you know, there's four main factors. There's habitat loss and degradation, harvest rates, hatchery influence, and dams that impede migration. So, you know, if you want to first look at habitat loss and degradation in California, the major impact, the first major impacts was the gold rush. You know, they unknowingly dredged out thousands and thousands of spawning grounds, you know, spawning habitat of spring, fall, and winter run Chinook all along these creeks and rivers in this area. So when the salmon came back, their spawning beds were gone. Mm. So that really kind of started the decline without us really even realizing it. You know, the tribes, I'm sure, started to notice, and they knew what they were doing was not going to work. You know, it was going to cause a problem, but no one listened to them. You know, and then irrigation, agriculture mm-hmm. started. They started to realize, wow, these valleys are really fertile, and we can grow a lot of food. And so they started draining a lot of the wetlands. Floodplains started diverting all the creeks and sloughs for their irrigation purposes. And so that also was a major contributor to habitat loss and degradation of their habitat. And then second, if you look at overfishing, we constantly in this capitalist system exploit any market possible. And even back then they were. You start overfishing more than what the ecosystem can provide. And, you know, also they were creating the conditions that inhibit the fish in the first place due to all of the mining.
Right.
And, you know, and all of the agricultural diversions, all of that habitat loss and degradation coupled with this overfishing. And usually they take them right out of the ocean. So they're taking all the fish out of the ocean that are gathering up in the bay and everything to start coming up. So they already decimate the run before it even hits the rivers by overfishing.
Right.
So that was a big factor. And then the third factor, which is hatchery influence, and there's so much there, and I'm not a fish biologist, and I've actually never worked in a hatchery, but I know people that have been around them, and I've paid attention a lot over the last, you know, dozen years to people that know.
Well, I know nothing, because mm-hmm. what I mean by that is, even if you don't want to go too deep into it, give me just a little bit, because I think of, oh, great, there's a fish hatchery.
Yeah.
That sounds to me like that's a good thing, it's actually, you know, increasing the population. What's the problem?
Let me first start by saying that I'm not 100% against fish hatcheries. There's very good argument to the fact that there wouldn't be really any salmon if it wasn't for hatcheries today. But that also doesn't take away from the fact that hatcheries have also been harmful, extremely harmful to the fish. And it all started with a man named Livingston Stone, who was no kind of scientist. He was a hobbyist, kind of like, you know, John Bidwell was a hobbyist horticulturalist, and he planted all these trees, and he, you know what I mean?
Yep.
That kind of person. He was wealthy. He had this money behind him, and he was able to study and research things and became known as an expert in fish.
Hmm.
And he found that the salmon on the McLeod River here in California were some of the genetically strongest fish along the whole Pacific coast as far as salmon go in the winter run Chinook. So he convinced the United States government to establish a fish hatchery. It was the first national fish hatchery on the McLeod River, and it was called the Baird Hatchery. And everything from then on, because he hired a lot of the Winnemem, because they knew about the fish, and they were losing all of their villages, and, you know, Native people were being forced into society. At, you know, if they weren't, then you were, you know. Anyways, we're not going to get into that whole story. Anyways, a lot of the Winnemem ended up going to work at his hatchery, and everything he found out that he learned about fish in their natural environment that he didn't study from books, he got from the Winnemem. And, you know, it was kind of all downhill from there because things started to be managed by humans. And when the fish would come up, they would, you know, essentially corral them into pens. Right. And they would just take the eggs out of the females instead of allowing them to go up to their spawning beds and lay their eggs.
Oh, okay.
So that started this whole process that happens today in hatcheries because living, you know, Stone was, he was curious and he was, you know, he was experimenting. Yeah. So, you know, they would cut the eggs out and they would drop them into buckets. And then they would take the males and squirt the milk into the bucket so they would fertilize. Huh. And then when the eggs became eyed eggs, they call them eyed eggs because you can literally see a fish eye in it. That's the first thing that grows. Then they take them out of the buckets, they hatch them out, and then eventually they release them into the river. One of the first things that started happening was the genetics started being altered because salmon back then were average 60, 80 pounds and above.
Huh.
60 pounds, maybe 40, was probably the smallest ones you would see. People didn't want to pick up the 80 and 100 pounds and cut them open.
Right.
And drop their eggs, so they took the smallest ones.
Oh.
And over generations,
right,
it weakens the genetics.
Right.
And then these hatcheries had to feed all these fish. So they started feeding them things, you know, like essentially any kind of pet food.
Huh.
You know? And so they're not eating what they would naturally eat from even day one when the egg was put in the gravel.
Right.
And then the milk was spread over them and they fertilized. They're taking in everything that that river is. They're no longer doing that.
Right.
And then when they're juveniles, I forget how old it is. I think it may vary, but they just take truckloads of tens of thousands of them and just dump them into the river all at once in certain spots. And all that does is create a feeding frenzy for predators.
Right.
You know, like striped bass and the pike minnows and birds and, you know, everything. So they're already right away, they're genetically inferior. They're not used to the river. They don't have the immune systems. They're easy prey because so many of them are just dumped in one spot. And they do it repeatedly in the same places.
Yeah.
I think they've started kind of changing it up. According to some things I've talked to Dan about, they stagger it a little bit more now and they go to different spots instead of the same spots over and over again. So the predators don't get used to, like, oh, yeah, there's going to be a ton of food.
Exactly. Right, it's dinner time.
They start gathering around. So that really started that whole decline in populations, too, especially the wild fish that still existed started having a hard time competing with all these hatchery fish that they just continually dump in.
Right, right.
And all the habitat decline and everything. And then, you know, that brings us to the dams impeding migration. Because, you know, the Baird Hatchery was put right on the McLeod River, just about where it used to confluence with the Pitt and the Sacramento, which is right where they put the dam in 1945. So when they built Shasta Dam, the hatchery went away. And by then, other hatcheries had sprung up that were, you know, national fish hatcheries. Hmm. Everything came from Livingston Stone's hatchery. The whole hatchery system started with that one hatchery. So pretty much all the fish that come out of hatcheries can trace some of their lineage back to that hatchery.
Ron Topi, I you just gave us the four factors in the decline of the Chinook salmon here in the North State. And the one that what you said, I have to sort of chew on this for a while, is the idea that they used to be, you know, 60-pound salmon, but people in the hatchery didn't want to pick up 60 pounds, so they only grabbed the small ones. That I am going to really have to think about for quite a while. I really appreciate that. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Ron Topi on the in the studio with me. Ron, you might be the first person in the studio with me since the summer of 2019, the very first one. So thanks for being here with me. I'm usually on the phone with folks.
It's so good to be able to be back in here. And you know, I had Jim Brobeck in here last night, and I've had Allie Matters Knight in here since I started the program, and I guess I started at the right time. It was kind of, you know, post-COVID when I started my show.
Okay.
And, you know, my first few shows were no guests, had to do phone calls, you know.
Well, I do guests every week. I just have them on the phone. I consider them guests, but in-studio guests is really fun.
For the most part, I do phone.
So what I need to do is, wait a minute. Before we take a quick break, what I do want to do, the original question, and then I distracted you by asking you to go further into the hatchery influence, is give us an update on the state of the salmon. You gave us the four factors in the decline of the salmon since the 1840s, but give us the current state of the salmon. Has the winter run Chinook salmon survived another year?
I can't say that. I can't say yes or no with 100% confidence. I do know that reports that I've read and articles I've read, and, you know, direct comment from people like Dan Bacher that I've talked to about this, and Colleen Sisk of the Winnemem, they're scared. They're worried because they don't believe that the winter run specifically is going to survive. Mm. They had 90% of eggs laid died in 2021. Mm. And that's due to warm water. And a lot of that, you know, just real briefly again, you know, these dams, they were built. One was Shasta was built in 45. Keswick was built in 50. And since then, specifically the winter run Chinook have not been able to return to their traditional spawning areas in the colder waters high up in the mountains. So one of the things they started to do was create spawning habitat for them below the dams. But that hasn't really worked because the water is too warm.
Right.
And you know, they kind of have to trick the fish into spawning there anyways. You know, the winter run Chinook is listed as endangered by the Federal Endangered Species Act and California Species Act. And, you know, they like to throw this one statistic out there that you'll hear periodically is that, you know, the salmon declined from a high of 117,000 in 1969 to 200 fish in 1991. That was a decline that they like to use.
Wait, 117,000 in 1961 to
1969 to 200 in 1991.
Oh my gosh. Uh-huh.
But that doesn't account for 1945 and 1950 to 1969.
Right. Exactly.
When the numbers declined from literally millions
right.
to that 117, which they call a historic high because they don't go far enough back. And that's why a lot of the numbers that you'll hear are very skewed, because they don't go back more than 30, 40 years, maybe 50 years in their numbers that they compare to today and year after year. And, they, you know, oh, it was a good run last year, it was a bad run this year. This year, you know, this decline's been happening for this, you know, for this past decade, whatever. So those numbers are really skewed because it doesn't go really far back enough. In reality, they've declined by millions, each run in the millions, to almost extinct in 80 years.
Yeah.
That's the reality. So you can get lost in the minutiae of all of that data, but that's basically the reality. And there's, you know, those four factors that I laid out that are the problem. The winter runs specifically are a big focus right now of the NOAA fisheries. And if you don't know who NOAA is, it's the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, and they have their own fisheries department. So it's been a focus right now of NOAA fisheries and both state and federal Department of Fish and Wildlife and DWR and Bureau of Reclamation, BOR. And for years, one of the things that actually spurred the Winnemem into run for salmon was they discovered that when that Baird hatchery was started, and they started this program of taking salmon eggs from that hatchery and introducing them into other rivers around the world to experiment, see if they could establish other fisheries. Those salmon from that hatchery actually took to a river in New Zealand called the Rakaia River. And so the Maori people have had this thriving fishery over there of McLeod River salmon for almost 100 years. The Winnemem never knew that happened. So back in 2012, I believe it was, they had a war dance on top of Shasta Dam to protest the potential raising of the dam. And a video about that, done by the Sacred Land Project, went out, and a lot of indigenous peoples around the world saw it. And in that was the story of how the Winnemem lost their salmon due to this hatchery and everything. That was part of the whole video. And the Maori people saw it, and they said, well, we have your salmon.
Love that.
And so, it just ignited something in the Winnemem, and they've been on this prayer, essentially, to bring those salmon back. And they've been pushing all of these different agencies to bring those salmon back. They've done a lot of work. They've gone to New Zealand. They've seen the fish. They've done the genetics. It all shows that they are the salmon from this river. They still have that genetics, the DNA, but they're still balking at bringing them back. And up until very recently, Colleen has had, and the Winnemem have had, a really hard time getting to the table with them and having a real voice. But recently, in the last several months, they've instituted, you know, essentially an emergency program to experiment with actually putting salmon back in the upper McLeod. They want to put eyed eggs into the upper McLeod. So they've actually turned to the Winnemem to help them with this project. Do you need to take a break?
I do need to take a break. And what I was going to say, Ron Topi, is that we are going to take a really quick break. And we're going to leave it with, the news has gotten so bad about the salmon that we now have some good news, and that is to bring in who you referred to earlier as the salmon people. The government agencies are absolutely clueless on what to do now. They have finally turned to the indigenous folks that actually have been caring for the salmon for lifetimes and lifetimes.
You know,
and lifetimes.
They'll say time immemorial.
Immemorial. We're going to take a really quick break when we come back. And what I mean by this is, don't go away, because when we come back, Ron Topi is going to talk about some of the exciting things that are happening around saving the North State, the winter run Chinook salmon, as well as the spring run salmon, from going extinct. We are so close to the brink. Don't go away. We're going to continue this conversation in just a minute.
KZFR Chico and the El Rey Theater are proud to present John McCutcheon live in concert this Saturday, June 4th. John McCutcheon is folk music's Renaissance man, master instrumentalist, powerful singer-songwriter, storyteller, activist, and author.
Take me back to the place where I first saw the light. My sweet sunny south, take me home, where the mockingbird sings me to sleep at night. Why was I tempted to roam?
A six-time Grammy nominee and one of America's best-loved folk singers, John McCutcheon has been called the most impressive instrumentalist I've ever heard by Johnny Cash. And Pete Seeger said, John McCutcheon is one of the best musicians in the USA.
There's a star in the east in the still of the night. There's 200 miles on this old road before the morning light. There's a hole in this heart of mine and I don't know what to do. And I swear that I would cry all night just to wake up next to you. Who rocked the cradle when I'm gone, my darling? Who's gonna rock your tired feet? Who'll sing the song? Tell me who's gonna rock the cradle when I'm gone.
This is an all-ages show. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Show starts at 7. Advance tickets are $20 or $25 at the door. Tickets are available at lraychico.com or at kzfr.org/John McCutcheon.
They'll be singing, they'll be shouting, they'll be dancing, there'll be drums. We will have a picnic, baby, come, come, come.
Don't miss John McCutcheon at the El Rey Theater this Saturday, June 4th.
All right, we are back, and I'm so happy you didn't go anywhere, because now we're going to turn the conversation. We got some good news, we got some bad news. The bad news we've already covered, which is really bad news. I have Ron Topi here in the studio with me talking about the fact that the North State Chinook salmon is so close to extinction. But I don't even want to say Ron Topi, the fact that the salmon are so close to extinction, that the various government agencies, the Department of Water Resources, NOAA, I wrote down a few more and they're not coming to me right this minute. Fish and Wildlife, they've gotten so bad at figuring out how to not only protect but to revive this this salmon run, they've actually turned to the local wisdom. So they've invited the chief of the Winnemem-Wintu tribe up north of Chico near the Redding area, Kayleen Sisk. Talk about what is happening in terms of sort of these new discoveries and what Kayleen is being invited to do.
Yeah, so basically what's happened is because the winter run Chinook have been in such decline, and last year was so devastating for them, that they've decided that one of the best ways to ensure their existence is to actually get them back up into the cold water of the upper rivers above the dam. So what Kayleen's been asked to do is help in consultation with areas up on the river where fish would have traditionally spawned. And they're going to place what they call incubation tanks along the bank of the river, and they will pump McLeod River water through these incubation tanks with eggs in them, fertilized eggs, and they will turn into eyed eggs, and eventually they will be put in the river as hatchlings and allowed to swim down river. And I guess what they want to do after that, once they get to the lake, is essentially corral them up as much as they can, put them in tanks, and they call it truck and haul. They'll put them in the back of a big truck.
You're kidding.
Around. Yeah, they haul them around to the other side of the dam and dump them back into the river. They've been doing that for decades. That's one of their ways of dealing with salmon to get them past dams. They've been doing it for a long time.
I have no words.
Yeah, yeah. When I first heard that too, I was like, "What?
What? That doesn't make any sense."
In some places, they use it. It's like a big log flume. You go to the amusement park, and you just shoot through this big tube of water.
Yep.
They do that to the fish. they shoot them through a big tube, boom, boom, and they just pump them through this big tube.
And so you brought that up as if this is good news. Is this a?
What's good news is that they're actually interested in putting fish back into the upper waters. Of the rivers like that, which is what Kalene and the Winnemem and, you know, other tribes too,
right,
have been pushing for. You know, I mean, the Klamath have been pushing for their salmon rights and their river for so long that they're taking the dams off of that river, you know. So that's another good thing that's happening. That's another solution that's happening right now. You know, in the Winnemem's bigger scheme, their bigger plan would be to bring the salmon back from the McLeod and essentially do the same thing they're doing with these hatchery fish, but also build a swimway so the fish can get around the dam.
Right.
And they've been pushing that notion for, you know, 10 years or more now. Their plan involves using, there's a big creek called Cow Creek in Anderson, and it confluences with the Sacramento River. And Cow Creek connects with this other creek, Dry Creek, that runs up toward Bear Mountain Road. I don't know if anybody knows that area outside of Reading. If you go through Palisadro and you cross 99, you get on Dry Creek Road, and it goes up to Bear Mountain Road and Jones Valley, which is one of the boating resorts, call it, on the lake. It's right there. It's a couple miles away. Dry Creek almost flows, you know, it starts right before the lake. So they could build a swimway from Dry Creek into the lake and allow water from the lake, which is essentially McLeod River water, down to flush through Dry Creek and into Cow Creek, so that the salmon can swim back and forth that way when they migrate. And, you know, it's met a lot of resistance, a lot of skepticism from fish and wildlife scientists, biologists, and you know, DWR.
Because they'd rather truck them around the dam.
Yeah, well, they like to micromanage every aspect of the salmon's lives, which is part of the reason why they're killing them.
Right.
Anyways, one of their arguments was, you know, we have no guarantee that the fish would even go up Cow Creek into Dry Creek. Well, this past fall, and I firmly believe that it's a result of the Run for Salmon prayer, calling the fish back. Kalene's granddaughter, Maya, she's 5 years old. Kalene actually pulled over just because their village is right there. It's like less than a mile away from Dry Creek. She had to pull off because she was on the phone, and she usually loses cell phone coverage by the time she gets to her house. So she always pulls over by the creek right there to keep, you know, to talk to people before she gets to the village. And little Maya got out, ran down by the creek. This was in the fall after that first big rain we had. We had that one atmospheric river that came through and dumped lot of water in around late October.
Yep.
So little Maya ran down to the water and was playing by the water. Kalene was on the phone, and she heard Maya singing to the water, and she started yelling, "Grandma, Grandma, run for salmon, run for salmon." And, you know, Kalene was, yeah, that's good. You know, she's on the phone, and then now Maya's by the truck saying, "No, Grandma, come see, run for salmon." So Kalene gets out of the truck. She walks down. Sure enough, there's a half a dozen big salmon spawning right there.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, so the salmon will come back. That's the first time anyone's seen fish in that, up in Dry Creek, in probably 40 years or more, is what Kalene was saying. So the prayer's working. The fish will go up as long as the water conditions are right. This was right after that big rain, so there was plenty of fresh, cold water. Rushing through those creeks that when the salmon actually turned toward that cold water and went up Cow Creek instead of heading straight for the dam. So it will work. It will work. And so one of the agencies that is involved with this whole emergency program of putting these hatchery fish and these incubation tanks up on the McLeod, which is the NOAA fisheries, is very, very interested in helping the Winnemem work toward bringing the McLeod River Salmon back. That is the one agency that really wants to try that.
Hmm.
So there's that.
So
and if my experience with working with the Winnemem, it's a slow process,
right,
bringing these things about, but little by little, the next thing happens and the next thing happens. 2 years ago, nobody was even talking to Kalene anymore. Now all of a sudden, NOAA wants to bring those fish back. Fish and Wildlife is at least interested in talking with NOAA, and they're putting salmon in the McLeod River again.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue. No, you're not. You are listening to Peace and Social Justice on Friday afternoon. This is Sue, and I'm sitting in for Chris Nelson. You're listening to Peace and Social Justice on KZFR. I have Ron Topi here in the studio with me, my very first in-person guest in several years. Ron Topi, we don't have a whole lot more time, and I do want to kind of leave this on a happy note, but one of the things... not by default. When things are desperate, I like to leave it on a desperate note so people say, this is desperate, I better take action. But there is a little bit of hope here. And I do want to ask you, you said in terms of the Winnemem Wintu time frame, Kalene Sisk and the salmon people, I love that expression, have been doing this work for a long time, little by little. For just a, you know, give us a just a quick sort of description of who these folks are that are really fighting for the salmon.
Yeah. They were the tribe that lived along the McLeod River specifically, pre-contact, pre-California state. The word Winnemem, its translation into English is Middle River. And the word Wintu essentially means people, so they're the Middle River people, because the Wintu tribes that lived up in the mountains lived along the Pitt River, the McLeod River, and the Upper Sacramento. So the McLeod is the one, it's in the middle between those two, you know? So they were called the Winnemem, or the Middle River people. And, they lost all their land. They had villages all the way down to pretty much essentially modern-day Redding. So when Redding grew up, they were pushed higher up into the mountains. But even when, in 1945, when the dam was built, they had allotments along the Sacramento River, you know, pretty much just above where they built the dam. And, lots of them worked for the hatchery at that time. But they were never consulted. They were never given really any warning so much that this dam was going to be built and they were going to lose all their homes. So they were just displaced with no plan to help them out at all. Mm. They were just displaced with literally no place to go. So over the years, a few elders that literally escaped boarding schools and went back to Redding, and they couldn't, recapture them and put them back in the school, that remembered their traditions, their songs, their ceremonies, and where to go to perform these ceremonies up above where the lake had formed on the river, started to bring that back. And Kalene was, she was brought into being the next in line by an elder named Florence Jones. And in the 1970s, when the Native American Freedom of Religion Act was passed,
mm-hmm,
Florence Jones was the first to apply for a permit to hold a Native ceremony on federal Forest Service lands. They were the first to actually use that act and file a permit. Since then, the Winnemem have all these documented sites up along the McLeod River and up in the mountains there that are cultural, historic sites, sacred ceremonial grounds, that they've been holding on to and working with the Forest Service to preserve them through what is now known as their Office of Historic Preservation, which is essentially Kalene and a couple other people along the way that have... there's one person in particular that's done much of the heavy lifting on his own the past 15 years or so. His name is Mark Miyoshi. He lives up in the town of Mount Shasta. so he's real close to the river and gets out there all the time. They're constantly in consultation with the Forest Service and DWR all over all kinds of things. You know, they're fighting the FERC relicensing of PG&E's power dams up on the Pitt River and the McLeod River, where they send McLeod River water over to the Pitt River so they have more water to generate more electricity. And they're fighting they're in consultation, and they're trying to stop the relicensing of that whole system. And, you know, everything like that, to other kinds of cultural monitoring when there's any kind of projects going on. So they also have a nonprofit organization called the Indian Cultural Organization. And that is how they raise money to do things like Run for Salmon and salmon restoration projects, education. They're starting a whole language program for their tribal members to bring back their traditional language to the younger folks. And see, they're not a recognized tribe. They were left off the BIA list in the 1980s when it was formed, because the state of California had to submit a list of all these tribes to the federal government that would go on the BIA list, even though at the time they were recognized by the Forest Service because of all of this,
right?
You know, all of these cultural sites up and down the McLeod. They have this relationship with the federal government. They have this relationship with the state. Yet the state didn't include them in their list because they weren't part of a rancheria dating back. So they weren't included in the list. That's one of the reasons that I understand what happened. There was a lot more to it. But anyway, so fast forward today, they're not on the BIA list, so they don't get treated with the same kind of
protections, respect, or anything
that recognized tribes get.
Right.
And they don't get any of the monies that other tribes get. So, you know, they have to do it through a nonprofit.
Well, let me ask you this, Ron, because I'm looking at the time, and Playing Dead is up next, and nobody wants to cut into the time of Playing Dead. And so the situation has gotten so bad with the salmon that the various government agencies, federal state agencies, have no idea what to do. So they finally turn to the folks that really understand what is going on. They really get the salmon, but they don't have federal recognition. They don't have the monies. They have this nonprofit organization, and one of the ways that they raise money to do this work, as well as to sort of coax the salmon back, is Run for Salmon, which you are very integrally involved in. In a just a minute or so, give us a quick overview and give us the time frame so that we can start getting ready for it.
Yeah, Run for Salmon began seven years ago, whatever year that was, 2015, 16, something like that. It began as a four-year commitment to travel from the bay and call the salmon back up to the mountains. And it is, the whole thing is steeped in traditional prayer, song, dance, everything. And after the first 4 years, we decided to keep going on it. Colleen was called to do it. Karina Gould was called to continue to do it. And so from that point, we started praying down because the salmon have to return to the ocean. So we've been starting up at Mount Shasta and traveling down to the ocean. And this year's journey starts on July 8th.
Which is earlier, because you got to go down before you can come back up.
Yeah. Well, you know, traditionally the winter run would travel down more in the springtime. But anyways, we're starting in July. We've done it in July the past 2 years, going down from the upper watershed all the way down to the ocean. And if you'd like to give to Run for Salmon, you can go to the Run for Salmon Facebook page, or you can go to the Indian Cultural Organization website, which is indiancultural.org. That's indiancultural.org. And there's a donate page, and you can donate through PayPal on that page, and you can designate money to certain things. Like, you can make a note, this is Run for Salmon or Salmon Restoration, or Office of Historic Preservation, whatever really you want to give to, you can do that through that page. Just make a note so they know where the money is to go. But, you know, immediate need right now, Run for Salmon, coming up in July.
Ron Topi, I'm certain that you will be on The Real Issue talking about this in the next couple of months, and I have a feeling you're going to cover it on the North State Water Report.
Yeah, so July, I'll be gone the whole month, but, you know, my show in July is the 7th. We start Run for Salmon on the 8th, so I'm looking at recording a bunch of testimony.
I'll get you on the radio. I'm looking at recording a bunch of testimony
for that show so that I can actually not have to be here on the 7th because I'll be up on the mountain, and I'll be gone for the whole month. So hit me up in August.
Yep. Ron Topi, thank you so much, as always, for your time and for the work that you do.
Thanks for having me, Sue, and don't forget to support KZFR.
All right, this brings us to the end of this edition of Peace and Social Justice, which is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico News and Review, hosting the best of Chico. Vote for your favorite Chico businesses by logging on to newsreview.com/bestofchico. The June edition features local history, the drought, wildfire recovery, and more. The Chico News and Review, your local source for news and entertainment with locations throughout Butte County and online at chiconewsreview.com. This edition is also made possible by the Chico Racquet Club and Resort, Chico's Tennis, Sports, Health Club. Amenities include 11 championship tennis courts and with LED lights, pickleball, sand volleyball, bocce ball courts, pool and spa, tournaments, leagues, lessons, clinics, and more. For information about membership or to a tour, visit ChicoRacquetClub.com. You can also call them at 530-895-1881. That does it for this edition of Peace and Social Justice. Up next is Playing Dead. Don't go away.
Everybody's gonna jump for joy. All the pigeons gonna run to him. Come on. Gets here, everybody's gonna wanna doze.
KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Mark Baker. Today, Friday, June 3rd, Big Chico Creek Ecological Reserve will be hosting their annual butterfly.